Hello there and welcome. Today is Tuesday, March 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a Russian probe confirmed, wiretapping claims debunked.
So President Obama could not unilaterally order a wiretap of anyone?
No president could.
Hearings begin for the president's Supreme Court nominee.
Our job is to assess how this nominee's decisions will impact the American people.
Iraq's prime minister praises accelerated U.S. support. Also ahead, the latest list of the happiest places on Earth. It's all on today's International Edition. FBI Director James Comey debunking President Donald Trump's claim that former President Barack Obama wiretapped him in the weeks before last year's presidential election. Comey confirming this on Monday at a hearing before the House of Representatives Intelligence Committee as he was asked by ranking member of the committee, Congressman Adam Schiff.
First, the president claimed, quote, terrible. Just found out that Obama had my wires tapped in Trump Tower just before the victory. Nothing found. This is McCarthyism, unquote. Director Comey, was the president's statement that Obama had his wires tapped in Trump Tower a true statement?
With respect to the president's tweets about alleged wiretapping directed at him by the prior administration, I have no information that supports those tweets, and we have looked carefully inside the FBI. The Department of Justice has asked me to share with you that the answer is the same for the Department of Justice and all its components. The department has no information that supports those tweets.
The president accused Mr. Obama and presumably the FBI of engaging in McCarthyism. As you understand the term McCarthyism, do you think President Obama or the FBI was engaged in such conduct?
I'm not going to try and characterize the tweets themselves. All I can tell you is we have no information that supports them.
Were you engaged in McCarthyism, Director Comey?
Try very hard not to engage in any isms of any kind, including McCarthyism.
The president second stated, quote, is it legal for a sitting president to be wiretapping a race for president prior to an election? Turned down by a court earlier, a new low, unquote. Director Comey, can you answer the president's question? Would it be legal for President Obama to have ordered a wiretap of Donald Trump?
I'm not going to characterize or respond to the tweets themselves. I can tell you in general, as Admiral Rogers and I were just saying, there is a statutory framework in the United States under which courts grant permission for electronic surveillance, either in a criminal case or a national security case, based on a showing of probable cause, carefully overseen. It's a rigorous, rigorous process that involves all three branches of government, and it's one we've lived with since the late 1970s. That's how it works. So no individual in the United States can direct electronic surveillance of anyone. It has to go through an application process, ask a judge. The judge can then make the order.
So President Obama could not unilaterally order a wiretap of anyone?
No president could.
Well, Comey also confirmed he was authorized by the Justice Department to confirm that the FBI probe into Russian involvement in the presidential election includes investigating any links between individuals associated with the Trump campaign and the Russian government. The hearing concluded with a sobering statement by Republican Congressman Devin Nunes, the chair of the House panel.
There is a big gray cloud that you've now put over people who have very important work to do to lead this country. And so the faster you can get to the bottom of this, it's going to be better for all Americans.
VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson was on Capitol Hill for the entire hearing and joins us now with details. Catherine, quite a day.
Nunes really summed up the feeling on Capitol Hill Monday, which was that there was so much buildup and anticipation for this House Intelligence Committee hearing because it was the first public open hearing, and we got to hear FBI Director James Comey testify for the very first time out in public. And there was a lot of speculation if he would indeed confirm if there was an FBI investigation into Russian election interference. And of course, when he did, then immediately, like Nunes said, there was this big gray cloud now hanging over the White House. What do they do? How do they operate under this environment, knowing that they're under investigation? There are so many unanswered questions, and the hearing really didn't do anything to address any of them.
What did the hearing do? What did it accomplish?
Well, it did confirm one big question on Capitol Hill, which was these Trump wiretapping claims that he tweeted about 2 weeks ago and that have been debated back and forth amongst Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill ever since, with just about everyone saying that they had seen no evidence that the president was wiretapped by his predecessor, President Obama. And as you know, FBI Director James Comey pointed out, there is a very particular process in place to get a warrant for surveillance, and no one person in the United States has the power to do that. So even if President Obama had wanted to do that, he could not have done that on his own. He would have had to go to a court, he would have had to get a warrant, and there would have had to be sufficient evidence to get that warrant. And he pointed out that today in the hearing. It's just not a possibility that this happened during the 2016 election.
There was a lot that the FBI director didn't say or couldn't say or wouldn't say. Not sure what the case may be.
The names of any individuals that may be under investigation, the nature of those contacts. And he kept cautioning that even a denial should not be read into as a sign that those issues or people are actually under investigation. So you kind of come out of this hearing with this maddening sense of, well, what actually is happening? And we just have to wait and see and find out. Now, I asked one of the Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee, Congressman Peter King, if there was a space for an open, independent congressional investigation that would clear everything out into the open for the American people, allow them to see what was going on and what was being investigated. And he pointed out to me that the House Intelligence Committee is thought of as one of the most bipartisan committees on Capitol Hill. The people really make an effort to work together with each other, and that if one investigation is already going on, is there really a reason or a sense to having another investigation?
Does this seem, in your view, like something that's going to be a long, drawn-out process?
You know, a lot of the members of Congress of the House Intelligence Committee were asked that today, and they couldn't even answer that. They couldn't even see a way that this ends eventually. Now, we will get some closure when that FBI investigation finally wraps up, but we don't know when and if and how that will be.
Where does it go from here?
Well, we do know that next week, next Monday, we have a part two of the House Intelligence Committee hearing where we get additional witnesses who were not able to make the first hearing today. So we'll be hearing from Jake Clapper, we'll be hearing from Sally Yates, so we'll get the DOJ perspective in there. So expect to hear a lot more questions and hopefully more answers in that hearing.
All right. VOA correspondent Catherine Gibson, we appreciate it. Thanks so much. Here are some of the stories that we are following at voanews.com. Thousands flee Mosul daily as IS battle intensifies. A new hospital to serve 50,000 impoverished patients. Laptops and other electronics banned from cabins of some U.S.-bound flights. Advocates say children suffer under the threat of deportation. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. International Edition continues now with more news from Washington. Senate confirmation hearings got underway for President Trump's Supreme Court nominee, federal appellate judge Neil Gorsuch. In opening statements, Senator Dianne Feinstein, the top Democrat on the committee, showed the anger that's still brewing over President Obama's nominee, who was not given a hearing.
We're here today under very unusual circumstances. It was almost a year ago today that President Obama nominated Chief Judge Merrick Garland for this seat. Unfortunately, due to unprecedented treatment, Judge Garland was denied a hearing, and this vacancy has been in place for well over a year. I just want to say I am deeply disappointed that it's under these circumstances that we begin our hearings.
VOA's Michael Bowman reports from Capitol Hill that if confirmed, Gorsuch would fill the vacancy created by the death of conservative Justice Antonin Scalia more than a year ago.
In a day of lengthy opening statements, Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley lauded Gorsuch's conservative judicial philosophy.
You should be concerned about the preservation of our constitutional order and, most importantly, the separation of powers. We have before us today a nominee whose body of professional work is defined by an unfailing commitment to these principles.
Democrats are still fuming that Republicans held the seat vacant by refusing to give former President Barack Obama's nominee a hearing. Senator Dianne Feinstein said there is much Gorsuch must speak to in the days ahead.
Our job is to assess how this nominee's decisions will impact the American people and whether he will protect the legal and constitutional rights of all Americans, not just the wealthy and the powerful.
Republicans hold a slim two-seat Senate majority and would need 8 Democrats to support Gorsuch should a 3/5 vote be required to advance his nomination in the full chamber. Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
Well, the inner workings of our U.S. Supreme Court justices and how they interact with each other have always been filled with a bit of intrigue and mystery. And for some insight, we're joined by attorney Anna Rose Matheson, partner at the California Appellate Law Group in San Francisco, who actively litigates in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and who served as a clerk with one of the justices, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, appointed by former President Bill Clinton. Thank you for being with us. So what kind of insights can you give us into Ginsburg, the oldest justice on the high court?
She is such an absolute inspiration. It was a complete pleasure to work for her. I learned so much about crafting opinions, about really trying to understand all the perspectives on an issue, about really taking your job as seriously as you can and trying to come to the right decision in every case. It was absolutely an honor, and she's a phenomenally nice person. She'd have tea parties whenever any of the people in chambers had birthdays. She would really cares about people that she knows and people she doesn't know. And I was going for her before she got quite the level of notoriety she has now, but still, it was absolutely one of the honors of my life.
Any insights into the inner workings of the nation's highest court? That's sort of a bit of a mystery to people, for the most part.
You know, in some ways, it operates like most courts. There are clerks for each of the justices who help prepare the research, advise, and follow the justices' instructions to make sure the opinions get drafted and put together in the right way. I think what would really surprise people is that it's actually a very collegial institution. Public kind of sees the written opinions that sometimes can be pretty nasty and full of slights and aspirations on the integrity and honesty and intelligence of the other justices. But really, the justices pretty much all get along. They have lunch together regularly. There's certain justices that are truly friends, but even the ones that wouldn't necessarily hang out together are all really collegial, and none of that animosity that you see in opinions translates to the workings of the court.
Attorney Anna Rose Matheson, who actively litigates the Ninth Circuit and served as a clerk for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Well, emerging from his first meeting with President Trump, Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi said Monday he was assured the U.S. will accelerate its support for the struggle against the Islamic State group.
We have gone a long way since 2 years ago. Nobody have imagined, even when I was here last year, that we'll be in Mosul today. And we have liberated the majority of Nineveh and majority of Mosul. And now the advance that our security forces has made is very courageous.
Trump, who previously supported U.S. withdrawal from Iraq, questioned whether troops should have been pulled out.
Our main thrust is we have to get rid of ISIS. We're going to get rid of ISIS. It will happen. It's happening right now. A lot of things are different than they were even 5 or 6 weeks ago.
Well, VOA's Victor Beatty caught up with former U.S. Ambassador James Jeffrey, distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute of Near East Policy, who had just attended the meeting today.
I was with Abadi and his delegation. I would say that delegation members were universally very positive with the reception they received with President Trump. They talked about joint efforts to secure a unified, democratic, and peaceful Iraq, to finish the job against Daesh and start the job of reconstruction. They discussed the regional situation, which is includes Iran and the problems that Iran poses for Iraq and for many of us in the region. I think that the United States made clear, without getting into too many specifics, that it is looking to a long-term commitment to Iraq's prosperity and security.
Does that mean perhaps the security agreement that was elusive in the early part of the Obama administration?
Well, there is a joint cooperation agreement that still is in effect between the U.S. and Iraq that covers all aspects of the relationship, including security. So you can put it under the aegis of that. You would have to work out the status of the troops, but the troops are there on a temporary status anyway, and they've been there since the summer of 2014. So we found a way to keep troops on now. The question is, will the Iraqis want them to stay? I think that if they do, the United States would be very interested in that.
From your sense of what you saw today, how big is the influence of Iran in Iraq?
I saw none of that today because, of course, they're on their best behavior. I know that certainly former Prime Minister Maliki is having his allies in Parliament call for Iraq to abandon their relationship with the coalition, particularly the United States, and get in bed, if it were, with Russia, Syria, and Iran. I don't think that's a good future for Iraq. I think that was made clear to the Iraqis the other day, and I think they understand that.
And what about the fight in Mosul? How's it going?
I just saw one of the Iraqi leaders had a map that updated it. ISIS is totally surrounded in the northern part of the western side of the city. Iraqi security forces are doing better and better, Victor. They're basically learning as they're going along and how to fight these devils. And this will be a matter of at the most weeks.
And what about the Trump administration's commitments? Will there be more U.S. troops in Iraq, in your view?
Well, again, there's plenty of U.S. troops right now in Iraq. The question is longer term. As long as there's an ISIS threat, there's no doubt. The question is afterwards, will we be able to keep troops there for training or counterterrorism? Because there'll still be ISIS elements just like Al-Qaeda elements.
Overall, you're encouraged?
I'm very encouraged. I think that this was a very good meeting, and a lot of the credit goes to President Trump personally. He led the U.S. delegation, and he really impressed people.
That's former U.S. Ambassador James Jeffrey, Distinguished Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all, from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on the Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
VOA's International Edition continues now with the latest on what's trending on social media. And for that, we're joined by Andrew Palcheski.
Busy day today on Capitol Hill here in Washington, not too far from our VOA headquarters, just up the hill from us. Mm-hmm. First, you had the hashtag Comey hearing. This, of course, right, is the FBI Director James Comey, who is on the Hill to talk about all of the allegations of wiretapping being made by the Trump administration,
right,
the allegations of Russia interfering in the U.S. election. And so you had a lot of moments emerging today from that hearing that were being shared on social media. But the general kind of feelings that you saw were anger from the right side of the political spectrum that Comey wouldn't talk about leaks coming out of the Trump White House and leaks of information, calls for Comey to be fired. and then from the left, praise
really?
Over the FBI. Yeah, the people saving hashtag fire Comey, people using that hashtag on the right, and then praise from the left over this FBI investigation about the rebuttal of some of the wiretapping claims. So big day on Capitol Hill for that reason. And then also on the other side of the Hill, the Senate side, the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing from Judge Neil Gorsuch, who is President Trump's nominee to fill the vacancy on the Supreme Court. So you have a lot of moments coming out of that hearing as well, and these two hearings happening kind of at the same time and swirling together in
social media.
So social media
was just blowing up?
Social media was blowing up, and there was a little bit of even crossover. People on social media calling for Gorsuch's nomination to be withdrawn or held up until the allegations of Russia's involvement in the 2016 election were sorted out. So you kind of had a little bit of crossover
there.
That's
interesting.
But one other thing I thought was interesting on social media, you have an account at Gorsuch Facts on Twitter. This is an account set up by the White House to correct inaccuracies and share facts and promote Judge Gorsuch's nomination to try to get him confirmed. This is an interesting tactic that we first saw, I think, with the Obama administration when they nominated Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court. They had at SCOTUSNOM, SCOTUS being Supreme Court of the United States, and they had a big digital push to try to promote his nomination, which he was not confirmed. But now with Neil Gorsuch being the nominee, the Trump administration borrowing that page from the same digital playbook. So some bipartisanship there, even though it's two different nominees, two different sides of the political spectrum, they're both using digital in the same way.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Andrew. You can follow him, by the way, at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. 8 million metric tons of plastic wind up each year in the oceans, harming marine life and entering the food chain. Mike O'Sullivan reports on a new documentary film called A Plastic Ocean. It looks at the problem and solutions.
Plastic sludge and garbage, a blight on the world's oceans. A film crew traveled the globe to document the rubbish. And Julie Anderson of the Plastic Oceans Foundation says what we see is just the tip of the problem.
Half of the waste actually sinks to the bottom. The plastic sinks to the bottom, and that remains on the surface actually breaks down.
The filmmakers found trash in ocean gyres, the circulating currents that trap large concentrations of pollution in the Atlantic, Indian, and Pacific Oceans, home of what some have called a plastic island.
So what we found in the center of the Pacific was not a floating island of plastic. What we found was a plastic smog that permeated all the water. And in some parts of the oceans, scientists have found more plastic than plankton.
The debris infects the food chain, sometimes visibly, and more so at the microscopic level, where the plastic particles interact with other pollutants.
Heavy metals, pharmaceuticals, industrial runoff. It acts like magnets. These toxins hitchhike on the plastic. And then when seafood ingests the plastics, those the toxins offload into the fatty tissues.
To be consumed by other sea life and by people. China, Indonesia, the Philippines, Thailand, and Vietnam are the worst plastic polluters. The United States, although a leader in recycling, is one of the worst 20 since it produces and consumes so much plastic. There are efforts around the world to address the problem, including at this newly opened recycling center in Lebanon. But Anderson says there is more that people can do.
Cut back on single-use plastics, straws, plastic cups, plastic water bottles, plastic bags, and finding alternatives like reusable materials.
She says healthy oceans are essential to our survival. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Well, Norway displaced Denmark as the world's happiest country in a new report released on Monday that called on nations to build social trust and equality to improve the well-being of their citizens.
I think it's the work-life balance. So we have a big safety net. So we get free education, free healthcare. It's really good. We're close to the nature.
The answer to why Norwegians are happy is... it's a bit boring. It's well-functioning institutions. So the schools, healthcare, police, all the bureaucracy treat people with respect, and that trickles down and makes us happy.
The Nordic nations are the most content, according to the World Happiness Report 2017, Publer, produced by the Sustainable Development Solutions Network, which is a global initiative launched by the United Nations in 2012. An advisor to the UN Secretary General says happy countries are the ones with a happy balance of prosperity, low inequality, and confidence in governments.
I'm James Partey, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listener's mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's been 3 years since Russia seized and occupied Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. Russia then staged an illegitimate referendum in which residents of Crimea were compelled to vote while heavily armed foreign forces occupied their land, noted acting State Department spokesperson Mark Toner in a recent press statement. The United States, he said, does not recognize Russia's so-called referendum of March 16, 2014, nor its attempted annexation of Crimea and continued violation of international law. We once again reaffirm our commitment to Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Since the occupation of Crimea 3 years ago, Russian authorities have moved systematically to suppress dissent in the peninsula. Human rights monitors have documented enforced disappearances, extrajudicial killings, torture, and punitive psychiatric hospitalizations, said Mr. Toner. Crimean Tatars, ethnic Ukrainians, pro-Ukrainian activists, and independent journalists have been subjected to politically motivated prosecution and ongoing repression. Mr. Toner noted that Russian occupation authorities have silenced and forced the closure of non-governmental organizations and independent media. International observers have been denied access to the peninsula. In addition, the State Department's most recent reports on the state of human rights, as well as on the condition of religious freedom in Crimea, point out that Russian-installed authorities have taken few steps to investigate or prosecute officials or individuals who have committed human rights abuses, created an atmosphere of impunity and lawlessness, and that religious congregations not explicitly loyal to Russia are subject to harassment and intimidation. The United States calls on Russia to cease its attempts to suppress freedom of expression, peaceful assembly, association, and religion, said acting State Department spokesperson Toner. Crimea is a part of Ukraine. The United States again condemns the Russian occupation of Crimea and calls for its immediate end. Our Crimea-related sanctions will remain in place, he added, until Russia returns control of the peninsula to Ukraine.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.
is for